Is behaving ethically getting a more complicated in the early years of the 21st century? Is it more acceptable to lie, cheat, or just bend the rules a little bit in order to succeed in our highly competitive world? Are the scandals involving Enron, Tyco, and Martha Stewart the exceptions, or are they just the ones we know about? And what about the new problems brought on by science? If we could use genetics to make our children smarter, should we? Anita Allen has been grappling with questions like these. She is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of a new book called The New Ethics, A Guided Tour of the 21st Century Moral Landscape. Her book is a professional and personal look at how life in America is changing with an eye on this question: do we need new ethics in this new age? Do you find that making the right moral choices have become more difficult? Are there more opportunities to behave unethically and get away with it? What are the 21st century ethical dilemmas that you face? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Anita Allen joins us now from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Good to be with you.
So you say in your book that our ethical map used to be clear, or at least clearer. What do you mean by that?
Well, it used to be that you grow up and you know if you were a girl, you were probably going to be a mom, a teacher, a wife, learn how to cook and sew. And you'd have to simply learn how to master the roles set out for you with grace and poise and virtue. And if you were a guy, you'd have to learn how to take care of a family and mow the lawn and so forth. But nowadays, we have a perplexing array of ethical problems that seem to be not adequately handled by turning to traditional values. And we have a lot of choices to make. And these choices that we have to make call upon us to really bend over backwards to figure out what to do.
So you break these problems down basically into three distinct areas, or three distinct kinds of problems that are caused by these changes. Can you tell us about them?
Sure. So I look out on the ethics scene, and I see sort of three predominant features. The first one is massive ethical failure in just about every sector: the business sector, politics, government, education, journalism, sports. There's lying, cheating, fraud, plagiarism, violation of clear-cut rules. That's one huge area of concern. The second area of concern is the area of ethical novelty. And this is where, you know, science and technology are giving us all these options. We can use genetic testing, we can donate organs, we can become guinea pigs in experiments, we can eat meat or not eat meat because of radiation and genetic engineering. And all these new things require us to make choices that we didn't have to make before, and we're all suddenly feeling very perplexed and clueless. And then finally, the last big feature I focus on in the book is something I call complacent island syndrome. And what I mean by that label is there are a lot of us who just don't know or how to deal with other people. We don't like other people who aren't like ourselves. We don't tolerate other groups. We don't care adequately about one another. And so this gets reflected in our underinvolvement in the political process in our neighborhoods and generally in the community.
Well, let's take these one at a time, because I think they're all three very interesting areas to think about. But let's talk about this concept of, you know, this lying and cheating, and you're absolutely right. There seems to be no day that passes where we don't hear about some malfeasance of some well-respected person. The question I have really, though, is it worse? Is it that the fact that we have a 24-hour news cycle, that there's so much more investigative things, an example of malfeasance that might have taken place, or a cheating scandal or fraud or something that took place in the hinterlands 20 or 30 years ago might be overlooked by the national media, and now it's front page everywhere and the media covers it? I mean, is it really different, or are we just seeing more of it?
Well, my own view is that we're seeing more of it. I do think that in the past, as you point out, you could do something quite horrible and yet no one would know about it outside your immediate community. But now with the internet, with radio and television, people know about what's going on all over. So things seem to be generally in a spiraling down mode. But I do think in some ways things are better because we do have more social equality. We have better racial equality laws, better gender equality laws. We know in some ways we're more concerned about the poor than we were in our great-grandparents' generation. We have more poverty programs, more social safety nets. So in some ways we're better. But there's this sense that things are really bad. And in 1998, Congress announced that there were record levels of youth crime and pregnancy and teen pregnancy and substance abuse and sort of saw this as a symbol of a great spiraling down. So while you might say that there are some things that are better, you might also say there's things that are worse.
You know, one of the things, before we go too far into this, one of the things that I found particularly appealing about this book is it's not written just from the dry professorial level, but you're very first person, and you even talk about your own ethical lapses in this regard. I wonder, you know, why did you decide to write a book that was so personal in a topic where, you know, obviously you're talking about things that that are embarrassing in some sense to talk about.
You clearly read the book. I made a very conscious decision to not make this book dry. I think that ethical life is very lively, that the kind of ethical problems we all face are extremely interesting, and that the problem is that we're embarrassed to talk about them, and so they don't get adequately aired and discussed and dealt with. So I decided I was going to write a book in which I was not going to stand back and point my finger at other people and be moralistic and pretend that I was a goody-goody-two-shoes all my life, because I haven't been. So instead, in the book, I talk about a number of times when I simply blundered, when I did really, really bad things. There are four major examples of my own ethical failing in the book.
We can wait if you'd rather.
I'd like to wait until the show's over to get there. But I do talk about some of those things. And it was a conscious decision because I want the book to be honest and to me to say, well, I may think that Martha Stewart did some bad things, but look, I've done some bad things too. We've all done some bad things. Let's try to deal with our problems together.
But you don't think that this is some sort of a major catharsis for you?
Well, in a way it was. I mean, mm-hmm. It gave me a chance to reflect back on my own life and to systematically look at how I became the person I am, you know, what role religion played, what role parental upbringing played, what role public schooling and private schooling played, what role the military played. My father was in the Army for most of my childhood. What role did my getting a PhD in philosophy play? And so it did give me a chance to kind of make sense of my own life, and I'm really glad I wrote it. Also, resulted in my refinding or rediscovering religion. When I wrote this book, I was not a member of any church. I hadn't set foot in a church other than to go to a wedding or a funeral in about 17 years. But something about writing this book led me to think that I needed to have something bigger than me to kind of to focus my energies, and so I ended up joining a Presbyterian church close to my home, and it's been great.
Well, I want to also get to the other two dimensions that we talked to, and then I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. But talk a little bit about the kinds of new dilemmas, the new ethical dilemmas that we face. I talked about genetics, but which ones are you thinking about?
Well, genetics is one of them. I tell a story in a book that I think is really a good one to get a grip on what the nature of the problem is. I had a coworker at the University of Pennsylvania named Janice, who was a very, very healthy, dynamic dean, and she had a half-brother who was dying of kidney failure and hepatitis. And he needed very badly to have a kidney transplant, but the doctors felt that he was not the sort of person who ought to typically get a kidney transplant, because when you have hepatitis, you're not a good candidate. But the experimental researchers thought, well, it'd be nice to be able to try and see whether or not somebody with hepatitis could also survive a kidney transplant. So she agreed to be the donor in this very experimental process. But think of the ethical choices she had to go through in order to make her decision. First of all, do you give up a part of your body for another person? Do you do it for your brother, if not for a stranger? Do you do it when the procedure is experimental and no one knows whether it's going to work? She told me that she faced ethical criticism in her community because some people felt that it was just morally wrong to cut up your body, to deliberately wound yourself for whatever reason. You had to go to the grave, they felt, in a whole condition. Others felt that since it's only her half-brother, she shouldn't give up a kidney for him. So she had to go through all kinds of cost-benefit analyses, religious analyses, all kinds of ethical and moral considerations to make her decision, and she ultimately did do it. And she, you know, she's ambivalent about it. But I mean, that kind of dilemma is new to the 21st century. I mean, 100 years ago, you would not have had to face that question: should I give up my kidney to my brother who's dying of hepatitis and kidney failure?
Right. But the interesting thing is, I mean, at least for now, there's no clear right answer. I mean, it has to be. You wouldn't call her unethical for saying no.
Well, you might think there's no clear answer, but it's not clear to me that there's no clear answer. I mean, I think that that one question is, you know, do these new issues in fact have clear answers? Because we don't have any traditions of ethical thinking yet to guide us, we don't know what the clear answer is. You know, maybe the clear answer is that we should, without hesitation, donate one of our organs to our kin folk. Wow. Or maybe the clear answer is that we should never take part in experimental procedures that have dubious outcomes, and the risk to our own bodies is just, in our own lives, is just too great. I think over time, we may develop a social consensus about whether or not we ought to engage in this sort of good Samaritanism. So I think that a comfortable place to be right now is to say, well, gee, these questions have no answers, but my point is they may have answers, we just don't know what they are yet.
Well, let's see if our listeners can help us with coming up with some of the answers, and let's go to Joe in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. When you had asked the question, you know, are people having a hard time these days finding, you know, their own ethical boundaries and whatnot, I first thought of Plato's Republic, and he had said in the Republic that the good life or the right life is known within inside of every person. And I think that your guest here just illustrated that in the dilemma with the kidney donation. For her, she must have come to the conclusion that it was indeed right. And that doesn't mean it's going to be right for everybody else out there. You know, those types of choices do become very, very personal, but she analyzed it to the best that she could, internalized it as much as she could, and she made her own ethical and moral decision. And I'm sure that, you know, in going through the process, she felt right about it in those regards. You may not, someone else may not. And I think that's really what Plato was looking at. Now, certain things you're going to know that are just, you know, absolute truths, regardless of the individual, and they're very easy to identify, killing, stealing, etc. But in modern times, I do think when you encounter dilemmas like this person with the kidney transplant, it does become a very personal thing, and you have to look within inside yourself to answer it. You can't be universal about it.
Well, Anita Allen, let me ask you, I mean, I'm curious about that. Is it enough to say, well, I've behaved ethically according to my own lights, and I don't care what the society says?
Well, yes, it raises the question, doesn't it, of whether or not ethics is about what individuals conclude they ought to do, or whether there are some overarching principles. There's an awful lot of moral diversity in the United States, and people disagree about all kinds of things. They disagree about what I call their moral lodestars, that's like what they follow. Do you follow Plato, or do you follow the Bible, or do you follow the Kabbalah, or do you follow Confucius or Buddha? These are real questions, and I think that there's no answer to that question. I mean, I think that some listeners may radically disagree that it's sort of up to Janice to decide whether it's right to have a kidney transplant. And Janice herself may decide that she made the wrong decision when she looks back on her choice 5 years from now. I don't, in the book, try to resolve the perennial question of whether ethical values are relative or absolute, but I do try to point out that there's a whole lot of diversity. We disagree about the sources of our values, about lifestyles like clothing and hairstyles and intimacy standards. We disagree about priorities. Do you save the whales or do you feed the poor? We disagree about our ethical theory. Are we going to be utilitarians or Platonists? I mean, these are questions that I think are up for grabs.
Okay, Joe, thank you very much for that call. Very interesting question. We're talking with Anita Allen, a professor of the law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She says new realities call for new ethics in the 21st century. What do you think? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking with Anita Allen, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of The New Ethics, A Guided Tour of the 21st Century Moral Landscape. And we're talking about how she thinks the new realities of today challenge traditional notions of what's right and wrong. When's the last time you faced an ethical dilemma? What did you do? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take another call now from Kevin in Memphis, Tennessee. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. How much can we blame modern ethical failures on the business side on just our basic capitalist concepts? For example, the employment at will doctrine, which I've sort of been victimized by, in which employees at the low level don't really have a choice, and so by the time they're high enough level in a company to benefit from it, they've been forced to cheat so many times that they feel like it's okay.
What, did you say the employment at will doctrine?
Yes.
Maybe you could explain that?
You can be fired for anything.
Ah, okay. Anita Allen, what about that?
Well, an interesting thing about this book is that the person who suggested to me that I write it was actually the CEO of a corporation. I think she was feeling like, you know, the business world needs a bit of an ethics lesson. There's certainly something to the idea that our pervasively business-oriented culture makes it seem like cheating is okay. And in the book, I tell the story of a man named Richard Turn who ran a group of hospitals in New York and who violated the New York State ethics rules by taking $700 in gifts from vendors who wanted contracts from his hospitals. And when he got caught, he made this very interesting comment that it was so fascinating, I actually clipped it out of the newspaper and like put it on my desk. But he said we're very confident that what we did was legally and ethically correct from a business ethics point of view. And I think what he meant by that is that in the business world, there's a whole other separate ethic. You're allowed to be a little bit ruthless, to cut corners, to disobey the rules, to cheat a little bit in order to turn a profit. And that idea, I think, is very, very prevalent in our society. But it has to be addressed. And I'm really happy to see rules like the Sarbanes-Oxley Act put into effect, because I think that tougher business ethics laws are one way to sort of curb the tendency of the business sector to ignore basic ethical values.
Kevin, thanks very much for that call. Let's go to Lisa in Goshen, Indiana. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Hi, this is a really interesting discussion. This isn't exactly maybe one of the most life-threatening moral issues of the day, but I know we just went on a trip from Indiana, northern Indiana, down to Virginia, visited D.C. and everything, but we drove the whole way. Of course, we took the toll road, and we had a Fuzzbuster with us. And my two children, 7 and 9, were asking their daddy why that thing was beeping all the time. And I really kind of had mixed feelings about it, because I thought, boy, what is this saying to my boys about obeying the laws of the land? And, you know, we had this long discussion about it in the car, but really didn't come out on any particular end of the spectrum. I mean, I didn't really know where we actually came out.
Well, Anita Allen, what do you make of that? I mean, this gets into your concept of a little bit of cheating, and it's okay because everybody does it, that kind of an argument?
Well, I do have a list of excuses for cheating and rule-breaking in the book. You know, it was just a little bit of a cheat, or, you know, I'm not bad, the rule's bad. Good for a little good purpose, getting what I deserve, everyone else is doing it. And those kind of rationalizations, I've used them too. But I do think that in trying to morally educate our children, we have a huge burden in trying to contextualize those excuses and to on the one hand convey to them respect for good laws and to teach self-control and so forth, but at the same time to let them know that in some instances it might be okay to break the rules. And I'm not saying you should use the Fuzzbuster, but I'm saying that we have an obligation to teach our children about the importance of rules and about which kinds of rules serve what kinds of functions. I'm all for more explanation. I think that one of the problems we've had with education of children in schools and moral education programs in schools is that they're too simplistic. You know, it's like, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do that. But then there's always, you know, but what about this situation? What about that situation? And I think that good ethics is going to be a little bit subtle and a little bit more complex than the three the three R's type approach to learning might suggest.
Right. And perhaps you would argue that just the fact that Lisa's thinking about this issue and raising it as an ethical quandary means that she's partway down the...
And she can present it to her children as an ethical quandary. You know, listen, you know, on the one hand, I think it's important to have speed limits. On the other hand, the likelihood we'll have an accident is probably quite low, and this device helps us avoid getting a ticket.
And in Europe, they have the Autobahn.
They have the Autobahn, yes.
Exactly. Well, it was interesting.
Okay, well, Lisa, thanks very much. And now I'm afraid I have to turn to Anita Allen, and after Lisa was kind enough to share one of her, well, it wasn't, I don't know, maybe some people wouldn't even call it a transgression, but you mentioned earlier that there were some that you included in the book that you're prepared at least to talk about publicly. So why don't you tell us some of the things that you look back on as ethically poor choices on your past?
Well, one that was little like Lisa's, but it stuck with me was I once wanted to see very badly the King Tut exhibit of Egyptian art at the Field Museum in Chicago, and me and a group of friends from school, we were all university students, got on a train from Ann Arbor, Michigan to Chicago and arrived in the middle of the night and went to the museum to get in line, but the line was already wrapped around the building about twice. So in order to be sure we could see this beautiful exhibition of gold artifacts, you know, from ancient Egypt, we cut line. I mean, we just sort of moved to the front of the line. And for me, this idea of the allure of the gold, you know, the idea of trying to get to Tut becomes a symbolic one. The idea of there are things that are golden in our lives. We all have our Tut we want to get to. So we're willing to break the rules of etiquette and the rules of ethics in order to get with who we want. So I look back on that and I ask myself, could I have done something different? At the time, it seemed that I would not get to see this art exhibit if I did not cut line, and that provided the justification for cutting line, that practical, pragmatic reasoning. But as a matter of fact, I probably would have been able to see the exhibit another day or another city had I been polite and took my turn and waited online, but I didn't want to do it. I was too selfish to do that.
You know, the other one that, that's an interesting scale of a problem, because I wonder if you would subscribe to the slippery slope, is that if you do that, well, what's next, you know? Or do you simply say, look, we're all going to be making ethical transgressions at some level?
Right. And the problem with admitting that you've made a small mistake is that sometimes people do infer from small mistakes that you're the kind of person who would make a bigger mistake. I interviewed for the book a Navy admiral who told me that, you know, the reason why they have rules in the Navy about, say, adultery, why adultery is considered an offense in the Navy but not in civilian life, is that there's a sense that people who violate trust and relationships in their personal life might do the same thing on the battlefield. So the smaller, more personal infractions become a symbol or a sign that, oh my God, you might do something much worse. So the person who cuts line to see Tut might also then, lie about the budget in a corporate setting, or who might cheat in her taxes. Well, in fact, there's often not such a slippery slope that plays out in individual lives. But I understand the thinking that, my God, once you get on the path to wrongdoing, there's no holding back.
We have an email here from Matt in San Francisco who writes, "People I know seem to have their ethics either based in Christian beliefs or secular upbringing. Do you see a difference in how these two foundations function?" Interesting. So can you lead a secular ethical life, or do you have to have a religious? Well, of course you can, but I suppose are there big differences between a secular and a religious ethical life?
I actually don't think so. I mean, obviously, if you're framing your choices in terms of Christian doctrine and biblical texts, you may often talk about what you're doing in very different ways than someone who's basing their beliefs on, as one caller did, Plato, a sort of secular source. But I do think that people who take the moral point of view at all tend to agree that a caring, cooperative, communal coexistence benefits everybody, and this is a starting point for good conduct.
Let's take a call from Pat in Cleveland, Ohio. Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad you took my call. This is such an exciting topic. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been a registered nurse for many years. About 20 years into my career, I took a course in bioethics as part of a degree program. It was the most valuable thing I ever did. And the reason was because I had experienced every ethical dilemma we spoke of, which was, you know, all the range of bioethical dilemmas of the time. And when I went into the class, I was so emotionally involved in these dilemmas that it was very difficult for me to learn. And finally, I was able to get to the point of studying and stepping back, becoming objective, and starting to sort out what my real values were, where they came from, and how I applied these in this in these dilemmas. It was wonderful. I say everybody should take a good course in ethics.
Well, Pat, that's an interesting question. I'd like to ask Anita Allen, do you think that an academic approach to ethical problems leads to a better practical understanding of what to do in a given circumstance, say in a hospital?
I can't deny that it does work that way for some people, that studying ethics can be the beginning point of being better. But as you know, I do tell the story in the book of how when I was a graduate student studying ethics at the University of Michigan, taking ethics classes from famous ethics professors like William Frankina, I was at the very same time in my personal life being unethical. I describe having a relationship with my best friend's boyfriend, for example. How was I able to sit in class and be enthralled by lessons in ethics, at the same time not take that understanding into my personal life? So I think sometimes if you're ready, especially I think more mature ethics students often do, directly apply what they learn to their personal life. But I think that sometimes young people don't make that connection between what they're doing every day and what they're learning in school.
Could I make one comment?
Sure, Pat,
yeah.
Go ahead.
That. I had been in nursing, as I said, about 20 years when I took that course, and I had suffered a lot of ethical dilemma problems. And so it was so good for me because I was able then to sort things out based on a lot of experience plus this education that I was able to get. Okay. I thought it was great.
Well, Pat, thanks very much for that call. Let me ask you, Anita Allen, we talked about the two legs of the triumvirate of issues that you discuss in the book. First was the increase in cheating and other ethically challenged behavior, and the other was the new problems brought on by technology, I suppose. But the final one, which we haven't discussed yet, is the notion that we're sort of insular and that we're not participating as much in our societies. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, some people may be surprised to see this section included in the book because I don't think a lot of people necessarily think that issues of integration and segregation and multiculturalism and obligations to vote and so forth are really part of the ethics framework. But I think that they really are. So I do decide to talk about what are our obligations to not just stick to our own kind and live in our own little islands of black people or white people or Filipino people or Puerto Rican people, rich people poor people. I think there's a tendency in America to sort of segregate ourselves into little comfort groups and then to therefore be deprived of the opportunity to get to know other people well, other types of people well. And that, I believe, undermines our ability to work together and to be participants in a democracy together. So I'm urging that people be more open to diversity in their lives.
We're talking to Anita Allen, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, about her new book, The New Ethics, A Guided Tour of the 21st Century Moral Landscape. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So one of the things also that I like about the book is at the end you've provided they're not rules, but they're suggestions for a better ethics. Can you talk a little bit about what people should be doing?
Well, you know, I didn't want to try to rewrite the Ten Commandments, but it struck me
that... No, they did a pretty good job with
that. Moses did a pretty good job when he came down from the mountain. But I did want to offer people something concrete, a kind of a takeaway message. And so I have this agenda for better ethics. It has 12 imperatives on it. And they are intended to be directly responsive to our current context, you know. So I urge people to, for example, take themselves more seriously, to realize that they have a unique capacity to figure out what's right and then to do it. I urge people to resist temptations, to accept blame, and to learn from their mistakes. I urge people to be cleaner competitors. I think one of the reasons why we're so concerned about the upcoming presidential debates is that we're afraid that we won't see clean competition, that we'll see dirty competition. But I think being a cleaner competitor is a very important ethical goal for our times. I think not trying to outthink ethics is an important goal. That is to say, trusting that if you do follow the ethical rules, you won't end up in the poorhouse. You'll do okay in business. You'll do okay in school. You'll do okay in the Olympics if you follow the rules. We need to nurture fair-minded youth, to get kids to think about fairness and to behave fairly, to look for the hidden ethical issues that lay behind, you know. So I talk about cosmetic surgery in my book. A lot of people are quite comfortable getting breast jobs or nose jobs, but I raise the question, you know, might there be some hidden ethical issues behind some of the choices we make that may actually have impacts on others or may say things about ourselves that really we don't intend? That's an important one. So those are some of the things I talk about in the book. And I think that a couple of rules that I suggest, like acknowledging interdependence, go directly to my last theme of the complacent island syndrome. I mean, I think that one reason to get out there and vote in November is because we are interdependent. We are dependent upon one another for our political futures. And by not expressing our vote, we're kind of saying, well, I don't think my preferences matter, or I don't care enough about other people's lives in order to share my perspectives with them.
But, you know, I'm still at the end of the day, if people accept all these, what kind of society emerges from that, do you think?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question, because right now we already have a huge number of ethical resources in place right now. We've got families. We've got religious institutions. We've got think tanks about ethics. We've got public libraries with great books. We've got TV and radio shows devoted to ethics. We've got character education programs in the schools. And by the way, President Bush has put more money into character education than any other president in history, but we're still not sure we're getting our money's worth out of it. We've got professional codes of ethics and ethics laws. The Illinois Institute of Technology has this website that lists 850 different ethics codes. So we have all this ethics already. So you have all that stuff. You add my 12 rules. What do you get? What kind of a world do you get? Well, I'm optimistic in thinking that maybe what you get is a society in which people are more engaged by ethical issues. So what I would like to see is people thinking harder about the choices that they have. If we are a society that's moved from a model of ethical conduct as coping well with predictable problems to choosing well in a somewhat less determinate, less predictable world, then let's be constantly vigilant and engaged in thinking about what's best and better to do.
Okay. Anita Allen, we have to stop there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
Anita Allen is professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The New Ethics, a guided tour of the 21st century moral landscape. She joined us from member station WHYY. When we come back from a short break, a debate dilemma. Rules for the upcoming presidential debates outline some strict guidelines for networks covering the events and the journalists moderating them. Should the rules be followed? Marvin Kalb joins us. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.